Good morning, Your Honors. Brian LaFraud on behalf of Sharp Electronics Corporation. Your Honors, the basis of Sharp's claim in this lawsuit is simple. MetLife wrongfully accused Sharp of misconduct, which caused Rudzinski to sue Sharp. The central issue in this case is also simple. Can MetLife be held liable for its actions? The district court said no.
I don't see how that has anything to do with ERISA, to tell you the truth. In the final analysis, as I understand this record, there is a resolution of Ms. Rudzinski's claim against Sharp that's favorable to Sharp. She gets some recovery against MetLife, but she doesn't. So that's over and done with. You're complaining, really, that there were transaction costs imposed on you from the alleged statement made by the MetLife representative that caused Ms. Rudzinski to add Sharp as a defendant for some period of time. So there's a period of time during which attorney's fees are being spent and transaction costs are accruing, and then it's over. Now, I just don't see how that has a thing to do with ERISA.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that we can state claims under ERISA as well as under state law, and that's why we plead.
Well, I've read your brief, but I think you have some persuading to do here. What's your best ERISA theory?
Well, the theory is that ERISA under 1132A2 and A3 allows two different causes of action. One can be brought on behalf of a plan for monetary damages. That's what Sharp is doing here.
But Sharp is not a Sharp isn't a claimant. Sharp, the company, isn't a plan. You may have had a plan, but the company and the plan are not the same entity. And I don't see why MetLife, although MetLife probably had a fiduciary, in fact, certainly I would say had a fiduciary duty with respect to Ms. Rudzinski, and Sharp, the Sharp plan, had a fiduciary duty vis-a-vis Ms. Rudzinski. That doesn't mean, you know, syllogistically, that MetLife had a fiduciary responsibility vis-a-vis Sharp.
Well, Your Honor, we would disagree.
Why are they a fiduciary for Sharp, the company?
When we, in our complaint, seek relief on behalf of Sharp and or the plan.
You didn't sue on behalf of the plan. You sued on behalf of Sharp Electronics Corporation. And your disclosure statement doesn't say anything about the plan.
Your Honor, the plan itself is not technically a separate entity. It's a component of Sharp, the corporation. It's not a standalone company. And I think case law in this circuit recognizes that, especially with these sorts of plans, the plan and the employer who sponsors the plan, who's the plan administrator, are often intertwined.
We've often distinguished sharply, though, to excuse the expression, between a plan and a company. You know, a company has a lot of discretion, for example, in how it structures a plan and what kinds of benefits it's going to include under a plan, what kinds of benefits it's going to exclude. And in its capacity as creator of the plan, it has wide discretion. The plan itself, once created, then has fiduciary responsibilities to the employee. So there are actually really important distinctions between a company and the plan.
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is in our amended cross-claim, we clearly do seek relief on behalf of the LTD plan.
I didn't see that. I mean, as your opponents point out, maybe you say that in your request for relief, but you don't ask for a penny in damages that was expended by the plan. The plan didn't give out benefits to somebody. Sharp, the company, paid lawyers, but I don't see where the plan is injured at all by any of this. They don't pay.
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. First of all, I would emphasize that we're at the pleading stage, and we did plead at the end of our count one breach of fiduciary duty claim that we were seeking relief on behalf of the plan.
How, in a Twombly world especially, how can you trace anything that you're complaining as damages to the plan? Plans, if anything, are better off. I mean, not to say that this is what I want plans to do, but if plans wind up not having to pay out benefits to somebody, then assets stay in the plan and they're available for the people who are covered by the plan.
I would say the plan is damaged in this case because Sharp and the plan, we contend, had to expend a lot of money and resources in defending this baseless lawsuit.
But where did the plan spend resources? I mean, there are tax rules that require you to have assets segregated to the plan. You can't just commingle all of the plan's assets with the company's general revenues.
Well, what I'm trying to argue is that when Sharp is faced with the prospect of defending a baseless lawsuit because its delegated plan administrator made false statements against it, Sharp's only interest now is to try and limit those damages. One way to do that would be to just scrap the plan entirely to the detriment of its employees.
But I know what I'm trying to get. I'm actually not even making the broader point that Sharp has no claim. I'm just saying I don't see where Sharp has an ERISA claim. Maybe it has a breach of contract claim with the plan administrator. Maybe it has some other kind of state claim. But I don't see where your problem, I mean, maybe it's an abusive process where they were litigating in some way. I don't know. I'm not their lawyer. But
well,
I just don't see how it has anything to do with ERISA.
Your Honor, if I can't convince you of that, then I guess I can move on to our state law.
That would be fine.
I'm riding along with Judge Wood.
Sharp pleaded additional state law claims as well as an indemnification claim under ERISA against MetLife. Those claims are run-of-the-mill state tort law claims, which basically allege that MetLife's actions were negligent and caused Sharp damages. I think all the concerns Your Honor just raised about this not falling into the ERISA context demonstrates pretty clearly that it does, if it falls anywhere, fall into the common law context. The sole reason why the district court dismissed those state law claims was finding that they were preempted by ERISA. At the outset, I'd note that it's highly ironic and unfair that a party who has no rights under ERISA, who's clearly been wronged, nonetheless has no rights under state law for obvious misconduct.
Well, the argument your opponents make about that, which perhaps you could address, is that even though these don't arise directly under ERISA, your state law theories would require interpretation and application of the plan's provisions in order to be adjudicated properly, and that brings them close enough into the ERISA zone that there's preemption. There are people who wind up with no remedies because of ERISA preemption.
That may be the case, Your Honor, but this is not that case. This court's opinion in the Biondi case several years ago set forth the framework for the application of ERISA preemption. And when it's state tort claims at issue, preemption is actually fairly narrow, according to Biondi. It only applies when the plan is a critical element of the claim. In Biondi, there was a fraudulent concealment claim made by the plaintiff. The Biondi court held unequivocally that merely because the plan is the context in which this fraudulent or negligent conduct occurs does not mean that the state court, state law tort claim is preempted. Otherwise, you'd have a situation where entities involved in the ERISA process have blanket immunity from fraud and all sorts of tortious conduct merely because they happen to act that way in a plan context. Sharp's claim here, it involves several components. We're suing based on the statement that MetLife made, but components of that statement are pure factual questions. One of the elements is they state that they did not receive premiums that were owed. Our contention is they did.
But, you know, it's so weird. I mean, they state that, but they also say, in at least as I understand them, in full context, they're saying we didn't get premiums from Sharp because no premiums were due to us from Sharp. And, you know, they remember, because she's found not disabled as of the time her employment with Sharp is terminated. And she herself, it sounds to me a little bit like a COBRA kind of arrangement, she pays for this continuation or extension policy. I guess it's called an extension policy. So she's paying at a much higher rate than somebody with coverage would be paying. And if the MetLife person said that, at least as I understand their position, now maybe you don't think that's right, they said to her, Sharp wasn't paying for you because you weren't disabled. I mean, why would you be paying if she's a terminated employee and she's not disabled?
Well, exactly, Your Honor. We had no duty to pay.
Exactly. So why aren't you standing here saying you have? Of course you didn't pay because you had no duty to pay, and that's why she didn't recover against you.
I think that's the basis of our claim. We clearly had no duty to pay these premiums.
So when they make the true statement, Sharp wasn't paying for you, that's somehow actionable?
The actionable component is they said Sharp didn't pay your premiums, therefore, because Sharp did not do that, you were ineligible for benefits, and therefore your claim is denied. That statement was false. They knew full well that we had no duty to pay these. They knew that our non-payment of these premiums had absolutely no effect on the denial decision. Nonetheless, they told her Sharp's failure to pay them meant she was ineligible. That's spelled out clearly in their correspondence to her. As a result of that statement, Rodzinski and her attorney felt that they had no choice but to sue Sharp because MetLife was saying that, hey, this is Sharp's fault. If Sharp had paid these premiums, you know, you'd have a claim, but you have no claim because of what Sharp did. That's the crux of this whole claim, is it's an absolute false statement as to Sharp's duties and the effect of Sharp's actions. They used that statement to defend the case against Rodzinski. Rodzinski based her claim on Sharp.
Was she already in this lawsuit initially?
She was. At the time that this statement was made, it was solely a claim by Rodzinski against MetLife.
MetLife, and then you got put into it.
Exactly.
What is the settlement? I understand it's a settlement. How does that impact the case, posture of the case before us now?
Well, it's our position that the litigation privilege that MetLife is advocating here has no basis, in fact, or in application. And the district court did find that the litigation privilege is inapplicable. There's a key distinction in terms of this settlement privilege concept that people throw about, and that's that it's limited in several respects. One respect is that it only really applies to the underlying claim. The parties to a settlement conference can't use statements made at that settlement conference to prove the claim against one another. But there's clear precedent in this jurisdiction that states that those statements at a settlement conference can be used in a separate dispute, such that third parties who are affected by those statements have causes of actions that can harken back to those statements. There are several other restrictions the district court noted as well. One is it's only meant to bar state claims. It only applies to defamation-type claims. And it only really is meant to protect attorneys and witnesses from the statements they make, not necessarily parties. I would also note significantly here that Sharp's claim is not based on the statement per se. If MetLife tried to raise this alternative defense in the context of the settlement conference, and then nothing ever happened, Rodzinski never sued Sharp, Sharp wouldn't have sued MetLife. The basis of Sharp's claim is the effects of the statement, and those effects are manifested in the actions that occurred after the settlement conference, such as Sharp being sued. MetLife answered Rodzinski's amended complaint in such a way as to confirm her allegations against Sharp, even though they knew they were false, and then MetLife refused to withdraw that statement for something on the order of 7 months, all the while Sharp and Rodzinski were begging them to withdraw it.
When you say they knew they were false, that's kind of interesting, because I suppose at a certain level I can see why you would think that, but at another level, if they weren't getting premiums, wouldn't that be almost a cumulative reason to deny her claim?
That may be the case if there was a basis for it, but...
Well, what if they just weren't getting premiums, and we have column A, they weren't getting premiums because Sharp just wasn't paying them, and column B, they weren't getting premiums because Sharp had no duty to pay premiums. Bottom line, they're not getting premiums either way, so isn't that more like a cumulative reason?
I would say, Your Honor, that may be the case, but those aren't the facts here. We conducted a 30B6 deposition of MetLife. They admitted that at the time they made that statement, they had no idea one way or the other.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm trying to suggest that that when the statement is made carelessly, perhaps, you know, well, we're not going to pay you because we haven't gotten any money from Sharp, or Sharp isn't including you on the list of covered employees anymore, or whatever it's actually implying. Is that actually inaccurate?
The payment of premiums is done in a bulk payment that doesn't specify employees. There is no way MetLife could know who the premiums related to in terms of which employee was paid. The 30B6 witness for MetLife admitted that they had no idea whether premiums had been paid. Nonetheless, they stated that they hadn't been paid. Which
how does this $5,300 then relate the receipts from Rodzinski?
Well, after Rodzinski's termination, she obtained a conversion policy to continue her coverage. The premiums under that policy were several hundred dollars a month. The LTD premiums were like $2 a month or something like that. She, over the course of time, paid $5,000 in premiums to MetLife. MetLife found that she actually didn't have a valid conversion policy for reasons I won't get into, and they decided to continue to process her claim under MetLife's plan. At the same time, even though they said she had no rights under the conversion policy, they continued to accept premiums for several years. It's Sharp's position that when they, in effect, canceled that conversion policy but accepted $5,000 in premiums, their statement that they didn't receive any required premiums for the LTD plan is, you know, contradicted by the fact that at the same time they're saying we didn't receive $8, we received $5,000 for
a canceled
policy.
Well, it's just they didn't
receive
it from Sharp. I mean, they received it from her, and they wind up having to pay in the settlement, right?
I'm sorry, I don't understand that.
MetLife had to pay her something in their settlement of her claim, didn't they?
Well, no, Rodzinski prevailed in court on her
claim.
Okay,
so she prevails in court. Yeah. But anyway, MetLife is held accountable for all of that.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
I see I'm
did
in my
you room. Reimburse Rodzinski then?
Did MetLife?
No, did Sharp any premiums?
Sharp didn't pay premiums directly to Rodzinski. I mean, it did pay the premiums it was required to during the course of its relationship with her. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ian Linker for Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. Just a couple of points before I get into my presentation. Sharp, in its argument, referenced the Biondi case. In that case, the plan was not merely the context, and that's why the court ultimately had ERISA did not preempt state law. Here, as Your Honor, rightfully pointed out, the plan is not merely the context. The plan must be interpreted in order to determine whether Sharp has stated a valid state law cause of action.
What interpretation of the plan is necessary? I mean, what Sharp is saying is that your representative made a careless, negligent statement that led to all of this litigation, that led to damages to I'm going to say to Sharp, the company that paid their lawyers for a couple of years. As we all know, that can be expensive. So what about the plan needs interpreting?
It's the extension of benefits provision, Your Honor, in the plan that MetLife cited in its brief, which says that a terminated employee who's disabled and in an elimination period can maintain his or her coverage as long as MetLife receives premiums. And when MetLife's attorney at the settlement conference made the alleged statement, that was the provision that he was relying on at the time.
But she was making, I mean, I guess I'm still unclear what in the way of interpretation of that. Everybody knew what the facts were, didn't they? I mean, I presume that if this is like every other thing, Sharp is just making some lump payment every month to MetLife. Somehow or another, there has to be communication between the plan and the plan administrator about which employees are covered individuals under that plan, because then, you know, otherwise somebody could come in off the street and say, you know, pay my medical bills, and clearly that can't happen. So what is it about interpreting this plan? Somebody have to figure out if it was a valid conversion policy?
No, Your Honor. The plan interpretation arises because a court would have to look at that provision to determine whether the statement made at the settlement conference was reasonable. That's why, I mean, you'd have to look at that provision to determine that. But that's not the only reason why ERISA preempts Sharp state law causes of action, Your Honor. As Sharp admits in its response to MetLife's motion to dismiss the amended cross-claim, the entire cross-claim is premised on Sharp's relationship with MetLife vis-a-vis the plan. Also, MetLife, as Sharp points out, did not raise the non-payment of premiums defense during the administrative process. So to determine whether that was reasonable, the court would have to analyze this circuit's ERISA case law. The Urbania case cited in MetLife's brief is one example of that kind of case law. And as this court held in Biondi, ERISA preempts state law when the claim implicates a core concern of ERISA. And here, unlike in Biondi, Sharpe's claim is directly related to those core concerns: fiduciary responsibility, disclosure requirements, reporting, plan administration. The amended cross-claim reveals that Sharpe's state law claims directly implicate those concerns. And unlike this case, the preemption cases Sharpe cites relate to instances where a fiduciary's plan administration was not an issue in the case. In addition, Sharpe ignores in its reply brief this court's decision in Lister v. Stark, which held that although the plan had no remedy, the availability of a federal remedy is not a prerequisite for preemption. Sharpe's breach of fiduciary duty claim fails as a matter of law because under ERISA, as Your Honor rightfully pointed out, plan fiduciaries owe duties to the plan, participants, and beneficiaries, not to other fiduciaries. That's a question of law. Sharpe has cited no case in its brief holding that a fiduciary owes any duty under ERISA to another fiduciary. Sharpe asserts its cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty under 29 U.S.C. 1132A3, which allows for appropriate equitable relief to redress violations or enforce any provisions of ERISA or the terms of an ERISA plan. Sharpe alleges none of this and simply points to its requests in its request for relief for a declaration that MetLife breached its duty to Sharpe and for any other relief.
Could I just go back, though?
Sure.
I mean, under the facts as pleaded by Sharpe, a MetLife person makes an irresponsible statement that makes it sound like the reason this plan participant isn't going to get her long-term disability benefits is because of Sharpe, because Sharpe has failed to do something that it was supposed to do under the plan. And we have to assume that that was a negligent statement, that it was inaccurate. We have to take all of those facts as pleaded. So I'm a little troubled at your theory that people in MetLife's position, plan administrators, can make statements as careless and irresponsible as one can imagine, and there's no remedy for the victims of those statements.
That's not really MetLife's position, Your Honor, with due respect.
What is the remedy, then?
Well, in this particular case, in the circumstances of this case, there would be no remedy. As you pointed out before, not all parties that perceive themselves damaged are entitled to a remedy.
But that's an unsatisfactory. I mean, you know, maybe that's true sometimes. I mean, I don't disagree with you. It is true sometimes. But in this case, as pleaded at this early stage, to say that there's no remedy for Sharpe, even though we have to assume that the MetLife representative caused Ms. Rudzinski to think that the whole reason why she wasn't going to prevail was because Sharpe had failed to make some payments. It's the causal link, I think. It's not the question whether Sharpe really had to or didn't have to. It's that she's led to believe that she's not going to get her benefits because Sharpe failed her.
The circumstances in this case are unique in that the representative of MetLife was MetLife's attorney. Sharpe alleges this in its amended cross-claim at paragraph 72A, that the alleged statement was MetLife's attorney's statement. Because the statement was made at a settlement conference in the underlying lawsuit, which was an ERISA-regulated benefits litigation, the litigation privilege applies. Now,
but what if it doesn't? The district court gave several reasons for saying that it did not apply to this third-party stranger's interest. Sharpe wasn't even in the room. It certainly wasn't there trying to settle the case at the time MetLife's attorney makes this statement.
The district court, Your Honor, held that the litigation privilege didn't apply. For one, the court erred when it said that MetLife's attorney didn't make the statement. And then the second reason it gave for not applying the privilege was that courts have not applied it outside the defamation context. And as MetLife cited in its brief, that's simply not the case. The court has applied the litigation privilege outside the defamation context.
But what public policy is served by barring a third-party stranger's action based on a statement made in a settlement conference between A and B, and now you're saying to C, who has been damaged by hypothesis, has been damaged by that statement, that C is powerless because A happened to be talking to B when this statement was made. I don't know of any policy that would make that make any sense.
It would be the same policy that applies to the privilege generally, Your Honor. As this court held in Scheib, the truth-seeking process of a judicial proceeding will be most securely advanced if attorneys do not fear liability as a consequence of misjudging the legality of disclosing particular information.
Well, but isn't the context, though, liability to the other party in the settlement conference? You want to encourage settlement. You want people to feel free to speak and to make representations, and then if the settlement doesn't work, the case can go on before the court. I'm not sure it's talking about third parties.
Well, the cases have not limited to just the individual parties in the underlying lawsuit, for one. And second, it's also important not to blur the difference between the settlement privilege, which some courts have held exists and relates to admissibility of evidence, and the litigation privilege, which this court has held relates to derivative litigation brought later on. Sharp cites cases in its briefs relating to the former regarding 408 admissibility, and those cases do not address the litigation privilege as MetLife's brief does. So that's an important thing to keep in mind that has been sort of blurred by the presentation here today. I understand your point, Your Honor, but the privilege has not been limited in such a way as I stated, and I do believe that the policy is the same regardless.
So suppose during this litigation conference, MetLife's lawyers had disclosed to Ms. Rudzinski some trade secrets of Sharp. For some reason, they know some trade secrets of Sharp, so they reveal them. And Sharp now wants to sue for breach of trade secrets. No lawsuit?
Well, I think the remedy would have been in the underlying lawsuit, Your Honor.
No, but Sharp's not a party to the underlying lawsuit. MetLife is talking to Rudzinski, and it tells her something that would be regarded as a trade secret of Sharp, a third party, somebody not in the room. Sharp finds out from Ms. Rudzinski that its trade secret has been revealed in breach of whatever obligation MetLife may have had to keep it confidential. Maybe it gives lists of customers or something. I don't know. Just bear with me that it's a trade secret. I can't imagine that you would say that the fact that it was said by MetLife to Rudzinski means that Sharp can't now bring a lawsuit for disclosure of its trade secret, unlawful disclosure.
That's a different case from the one.
I know it, but it's the same pattern. It's the same pattern in that a negligent act within the settlement discussion has harmed a third-party stranger to the settlement discussion, and they now want to sue.
But Sharp does not allege that the statement, the alleged negotiation statement, was negligent, and it certainly doesn't explain in its amended cross-claim how it was negligent.
I thought they did say it was negligent. I thought these were negligent inducement, negligent.
Yeah, they assert those causes of action, but they don't explain the basis for how the alleged statement was negligent. And under Twombly, merely asserting conclusions that there was negligence is insufficient. Excuse me, the amended cross-claim, which is why we're here today to talk about the amended cross-claim, does not sufficiently explain the basis for those claims. It doesn't explain how the alleged statement was negligent or wrongful. Instead, it just baldly makes those assertions. Sharp state law causes of action for negligent misrepresentation, negligent inducement, and its cause of action for abuse of process fail as a matter of law because with respect to the negligent misrepresentation and inducement claims, Sharp has not alleged that it reasonably relied on the alleged statement. Sharp's efforts in its reply brief at page 16 to convince the court otherwise do not change this. Sharp cites two cases in its reply at page 16 brought under the U.S. mail and wire fraud statutes in an effort to argue that plaintiffs who assert Illinois negligent misrepresentation claims don't need to show that they relied on the misrepresentation as long as someone else did. What Sharp fails to mention is that mail and wire fraud have no reliance requirement.
I'm looking at the amended complaint, though, and they allege that MetLife's statement to Rudzinski was false, contradictory, misleading, and wrongful. And then if you go into the particular counts, for example, count three, negligence, they allege that MetLife's statement was a breach of the duty, that MetLife was made the statement willfully and maliciously or done with reckless indifference to Sharp, and on and on, the negligent. I mean, I don't know what else they can say other than MetLife knew that it was wrong and they made the statement anyway. I mean, what other detail is there?
Well, I mean, because this case has such a unique it arises in such a unique circumstance and situation, you'd have to go back to the plan. Now, Sharp, in order to say that it was a negligent misrepresentation, would have to show that it was inaccurate under the terms of the plan. And for obvious reasons, for its state law causes of action, Sharp wouldn't want to do that, because if interpretation was necessary, as MetLife argues here, then ERISA would preempt those causes of action. It's interesting to note, Your Honors, that if you look at the paragraphs that you were just reading from, Sharp argues that its state law causes of action in paragraphs 45 and 46 is the negligence cause of action. MetLife owed Sharp a duty with respect to its performance and exercise of its functions under the policy and the plan, and with respect to the defense of plaintiff's lawsuit. MetLife had a duty to inform Sharp and plaintiff of each and every basis for its denial of plaintiff's claim during the claims process. That is directly tied to the duties under ERISA. And it goes on. I mean, to the extent Sharp's indemnification arises under state law, it's the same thing in paragraph 36 of the amended cross-claim. In none of MetLife's denial letters, nor in any correspondence sent to plaintiff during the process and evaluation of her claim, their breach of fiduciary duty claim under common law, paragraph 74, MetLife owed Sharp a fiduciary duty based on the special circumstances of their relationship, in that MetLife handled the processing of long-term disability benefit claims under the plan and determined whether to grant or deny claims. In light of this, Your Honor, it's clear that those state law claims are so directly tied to ERISA duties that ERISA must preempt those state law claims. And if I may return, Your Honor, to Sharp's abusive process claim, that claim fails as a matter of law because MetLife has not availed itself of the court's formal process, which is a requirement to assert such a cause of action. In all of the cases cited by Sharp, the defendant had used the court's process by asking the court to issue formal process by either initiating litigation or seeking leave of court to amend a complaint it previously filed. And Sharp cites no cases for its theory that the alleged statement induced Radzinski to amend her complaint to add Sharp as a defendant is somehow an abusive process. Now, Sharp also spends a great deal of time arguing that the law of the case doctrine applies. Those arguments are misplaced. As MetLife stated in its brief, that doctrine doesn't apply to prejudgment orders such as motions to dismiss, as they are interlocutory and a court may reconsider them at any time. In addition, the law of the case only applies to issues actually decided, and as MetLife stated in its brief, the district court, when making its determination to deny the motion to dismiss the original cross-claim, did not consider really any of the same issues that the district court ultimately dismissed the amended cross-claim on. The district court considered only standing in deciding whether Sharp had stated a breach of fiduciary duty claim and did not consider whether the statutes on which Sharp relied entitled it to the relief it sought. In reaching its decision, the court did not decide preemption, but instead held that Sharp had sufficiently stated an indemnification claim, which was, as MetLife contends, error, because at the time the court decided to deny the motion to dismiss the original cross-claim, Sharp could no longer be liable in the underlying lawsuit. And that's a requirement of indemnification, that there must be underlying liability. In all of Sharp's cases, acknowledge this, with the exception of the Packer decision that was discussed by MetLife in its brief. Sharp also asserts a claim for indemnification under ERISA, but because it hasn't properly alleged plan losses and because it cannot be liable or even potentially liable in the underlying lawsuit, as that case is over, Sharp cannot set forth a valid indemnification claim under ERISA as well. Sharp's Sharpe's efforts to convince the court that the district court erred in refusing to retain supplemental jurisdiction over Sharpe's state law claims demonstrate how Sharpe has litigated this case. The district court did not abuse its discretion because it never actually exercised any. The plain language of the court's decision shows that it dismissed the state law claims on preemption grounds and hypothetically stated that even if it had not dismissed them, it would not have retained supplemental jurisdiction over those causes of action.
Of course, there's a difference. I mean, the way the court does dismiss them on preemption grounds, that's a merits dismissal, whereas a 1367 dismissal would have been without prejudice, presumably.
Presumably, but again, it was stated as a hypothetical statement.
He
dismissed the state law claims because he found.
But as of now, they're dismissed with prejudice, unless this court does something.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's because Sharpe initially asked the court to enter final judgment against it. That mm-hmm. precludes Sharpe from seeking or from amending its complaint in the case Foster v. DeLuca. It is for these reasons, Your Honors, and for those stated in MetLife's briefs, that the court should affirm the district court's decision dismissing the amended cross-claim in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Linker. How much time does Mr. Ferretta have? You have 3 minutes.
Your Honors, a couple of points. Sharpe state law claims, first of all, MetLife's position clearly in this case is that they have blanket immunity to say whatever they want in the context of denying claims, even if that leads to parties that they have relationship with getting sued. That's clearly not a proper result, as Your Honor noted. I think it's also important to keep in mind that Sharpe state law claims do, in fact, advance the interests of ERISA. This isn't a preemption situation where the claims are at odds with ERISA's stated policy. Sharpe's claims here allow a plan that's been wrongfully sued in the context of offering an ERISA plan to recover those damages, which will lead them to continue offering these benefits to their employees.
I'm still having trouble figuring out what damages have been inflicted on the plan.
Well, I'm not contending that right now. I'm saying Sharpe itself being damaged, if it's financially damaged.
So anytime a company's damaged, its ERISA plans are also damaged.
That's what I was contending earlier as to our ERISA claims. I'm saying that with respect to our state law claims.
All
when
right.
Sharpe itself is damaged.
Sharpe itself for the state law claims.
It's right. going to be inclined not to offer these sorts of benefits because it's a source of liability now. It's not a benefit. It's a benefit to the employees, but it's also an opening for liability if the plan administrator chooses to implicate Sharpe in its benefits denial decisions.
The situation now is that MetLife is paying benefits to Rudzinski. Right.
Well, they reached a settlement after Brzezinski obtained judgment.
But, I mean, that's the status of it now.
I don't know if it was a bulk payment or a payment over time, but they did make some sort of a payment.
All right.
I mean, I wasn't a party to the settlement agreement, so I just can't comment on that.
So this in effect, I mean, the bottom line, this is separate litigation on a state law claim, or at least it's.
Exactly. You know, the Sharpe's relationship with Brzezinski is obviously over with, and they're just seeking to recover their damages by being wrongfully sued. I'd also note that the litigation privilege, as Your Honor indicated, it is kind of narrow, and we're not contending that a party is limited in what they could say in settlement negotiations. All we're saying is they have a duty to, when they say something, if it leads to derivative litigation against a third party, they're going to be on the hook for that. And I believe that the trade secrets example is a good example of just that sort of situation. I'd also note that our state law claims, although the plan is sort of at issue here, the duty to not misrepresent facts flows solely from state law, and Sharpe's able to state state law claims based on that state duty not
to
misrepresent.
Is it a misrepresentation of facts or a misrepresentation of the scope of duties under the plan for Sharpe?
I would say it's a misrepresentation of facts primarily, because you could look at the facts of whether payments were paid or received or even at issue without necessarily getting into the plan. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel.